but bowl breaking. That was the way the universe sort of came together in that moment. And that is a kind of vertical dimension, sort of cutting through this linear one. And see, that's the sudden enlightenment, to see this is the Buddha nature. This is the universe conspiring at this time. And note that cuts right through my linear progression, which involves all the bad things, clumsiness there, and freeing myself of clumsiness in the future, comes right through that. And so the enlightenment comes right in the midst of my imperfections, right in the midst of my bowl breaking. Now, the sudden enlightenment does not annul the gradual enlightenment, because Huineng still continued to sit and so on, and I should, for a certainty, still try to be more careful in the future. It doesn't cancel out the linear gradual point of view at all. But, you see, what it points out is, if we stay only with the linear, you'll never make it. You know? No. I'd like to just finish this and then we'll talk about it. You see, no amount of carefulness is ever going to guarantee that my fingers will never again slip. And that's another way of saying that no amount of practice will ever make us perfect. So the linear is never going to carry us all the way. And therefore, something else must be added from vertical dimension that cuts right through that linear without annulling it, without derogating it or pushing it aside. Now, please.
Well, it would just seem that at that point of enlightenment,
go on.
There is no, the past and the future don't exist.
Right.
So that means that it's not only the discursive mind, okay, but it's also the part of the mind that makes the past and the future.
Which is a part of the discursive, right?
I don't know.
Okay.
Is it?
I think so.
It's the mind that reflects.
I think that's excellent. That's a wonderful way to
say it. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
come.
What I like is having, you know, in this, the sudden and the gradual, knowing that the sudden, as you say, it happens in that mind moment of the present, and then you most usually lose enlightenment a mind moment after you've attained.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of the dance, which includes both, is that the practice allows for the possibility of this, you know, the sudden emerging again, because the field is, or the soil is being continually enriched,
right,
through the experience of practice.
Right. Right.
And what worries me about the sudden, because the Zen master I work with is sudden style, Chogyi.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's southern style, and but practice is very important as well.
Oh, sure.
And the problem for me with the sudden, in particularly in the materialistic Western world, it's like, you know, LSD, is if that's going to do it for you. Mm-hmm. And it, in fact, I believe never happens that way, or so rarely happens that way, that it's just almost, you know, one wishes that it weren't that way. But that other aspect needs the maintenance of the garden needs to go on, so mm-hmm. that the opening can happen more and more often.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Houston, just in the question about practice, because it's a real issue here, as you can imagine, with so many teachers
coming
through. in the Gnostic world, do we know what practices, if any, were part of that tradition?
Oh, very good question. I think we know a lot about the exoteric. That would mean what the rituals were involved in the Manichaean religion and things like that. I don't know, but I think they're there. I sense that this is this is known. But for this last mystical knowledge, any practices that would be kind of preparing the mind therefrom, other than the kind of knowledge of the first four, which are just ancillary types, I don't know. I don't know if we have that. I'm not. Wouldn't that be interesting?
Well, just because the aspect of contemplation,
right,
is so relevant in Eastern traditions.
That's right.
And it is not generally accessible in Christianity,
right,
except to, of course, those who have taken monastic vows. The laity is left out in the cold with regards to real practice.
Yeah.
As far as I know, I mean, and I don't know whether if there's something indicated in the early Christian tradition which included the laity, you know, us folks, the junior leagues, so to speak, and or whether this was an esoteric, an elitist situation.
Are you familiar with the round dance?
It's only, you know, from Joe's description, which would seem like a wonderful way.
I think that that points towards something. Now, obviously it isn't clear, but it seems to me that this certainly points towards some kind of esoteric practice.
That was generally accessible in terms of an ecstatic.
Well, now, I couldn't say about that. I, mm-hmm. Since it was written, it should be reasonably generally accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But I, like most of those things, it isn't too complete.
Yeah.
But it certainly suggests that there was another layer of knowledge available, or another more tools. I mm-hmm. brought a copy of it up just
mm-hmm.
in case. I talked to you about it, I think, several years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would be an active meditation in terms of a passive contemplative practice. Do we know?
No, it was more of a dance.
Yeah.
I mean, really a dance.
Yeah.
The round dance? Oh, not the dervish?
No, no. This was the round dance of Jesus that was supposedly taught to a certain Gnostic group after his resurrection. And it's a rather interesting thing. It's written up. It was written up among the Arrhenius papers that Joe edited. That's where I first ran into it, and then I found several other references to it. Yeah.
It's so incredibly beautiful.
It is.
Poetry of that.
I brought it
along.
Just
yeah, good. I'd like to. No, I don't. I've heard about it, but I don't think. I certainly don't have it in mind. And
I'll tell you what I would love. I would love to have it read tomorrow morning. Almost in.
I'll present it to you tonight, and you may read it tomorrow.
Oh, good. Oh, good. No, I think we should have. I think that's a great idea. Yes?
Two questions, and I really don't know very much about what you're talking about. One of them in monastic life, didn't they use the rosary to a very great extent as a tool of meditation? That was what
right.
I always understood.
Now, but the thing is that the rosary, well, no, you're right. Exactly, the rosary in both the Buddhist and the Christian tradition is used as a way of focusing the mind through,
mm-hmm.
through
yeah.
prayer, through mantra.
And the other thing that I read, and I don't know very much about it, but I understand that in the Greek Orthodox, which again goes back to these things, that there are rather extensive meditative techniques, not too unlike yoga, but they're quite, matter of fact, they are almost the antithesis of the Roman view as far as meditative and kind of seeking for spiritual enlightenment. They're also very ritualistic, but that there is a quite an active and powerful undercurrent of mysticism in Eastern. Now, I just read that in the book, and I wasn't swear to it, but I think,
you know,
I think it's there, or at least part of it's there.
The reason why not I asked Houston to do this program in part was the fact that in Gilles, you know, that my own tradition, which is Christian, had sort of left me at high and or low and dry. And when it became really poignant for me when I attended a Christian Buddhist conference in Boulder this summer and saw Buddhist and Christian contemplatives, including Brother David and Father Thomas Keating,
mm-hmm.
and Sister Therese of Father McNamara's, you know,
mm-hmm.
incredible group of young people and so on, with the, you know, the Zen masters and the Dharma masters of various Buddhist traditions, and looked at those people and realized that there was just an incredible sense about them which was similar.
Mm-hmm.
That the process of active contemplation, those people who really do meditation, I didn't care, it didn't make any difference whether they were Christian or Buddhist, there were semantical discussions of some interest, but there was a quality of refinement of the spirit which both these groups manifested in a tangible form. So at the end, I mean, there were 1,000 people there, and we all had the sense of, and what was really for me was that as a Buddhist, I can sit as a lay person. But as a Christian, it is very difficult for me to find a place to go into, you know, into correct aspects of the, you know, contemplative process as a lay individual.
Wow.
And that thing is, you know, it's just yeah. rubbed me for years as a Christian Buddhist type, and wanting to know whether somehow in the Gnostic field there was a beginning of this possibility because of the, you know, experiential nature that one senses in the Gospels, in these Gospels.
There was something else that was brought up here today, and maybe we'll touch on it later, but this is your experience. One of the things that has always bothered me is the essential of apartness. I don't know how we're going to get one world and one humanity until we somehow get people to be a little more considerate of one another's religions. And yet, not only did you have the Buddhists and the Christians, but I understand you can add the Sufis to that, and until it becomes prayer time, you can't tell the difference between a Sufi mystic and particularly in the early Christian mystics. They were extremely similar in some of their performances, and they also got a lot of interplay of ideas between them. The Sufi was very much influenced by early Christianity and by Neo-Platonism. And the way some of this thing worked in one of the few areas where people do get together, this is, I just wrote a paper on this, so it's dear to me. But the Sufis were the unifying influence, in a sense, the only unifying influence. When the Muslims conquered India, they were mostly Persians and kept apart, but all the missionary work was done by the Sufis, because with their meditative techniques and they were much more compassionate and tolerant. And this is again this mystical approach, and the Hindus thought, hey, you know, this isn't all that bad. And, so this mystical thing is a unifying force in the world, and I don't know where it's going to lead us, but it's one of the things that I find very fascinating about. Excuse me, that's a discourse.
No, I think that's real, but. It relates to our theme here, because to me the question is, I think it's beyond doubt that the mystic does unify, but it's this Gnostic versus, what should we say, the other approach, which seems, what should we say, difficult to integrate. I'm thinking about, in Indian terms, it's the jhanic versus the bhaktic. Now, in India, I think a reasonable integration has occurred, and they've gotten along on the whole very well with one another. But in the West, we're back to the fact that the mystics have had a hard time. But what does that come to? I guess it doesn't come to the fact that there are different kinds of people that cut within a single tradition. I'm thinking here of the Christian, where you have the Gnostic and the non-Gnostic approach. Can they get together? Seems to me to be harder than whether Gnostics can get together with Sufis or Bhakti or Jhanic Indians. Well, I don't know. If you want to respond, why? I do.
Houston, I as a staff person have to run and do some things just at this little nexus. So
right.
You'll excuse a few staff members from ducking out for
sure.
In fact,
what do we do? Go till 5? Or
yeah,
what do we?
It would be good to go till 5, and then we'll have dinner at 6 o'clock, and then we'll do the films at 7. Because I know you're on East Coast time.
Good.
And those people who feel vigorous, what I want to do is grab you by the scruffs at the point of this conclusion to help with a few transitional chores.
That fancy talk for getting put to work.
Yeah.
The thing about this community is you think it's karma yoga.
When the chips are down.
I would like to hear how you would answer the question that you just answered. Christianity, the two divisions in Christianity.
That last question? Now, if it's a question about if we take the Gnostics as the way of knowledge, and which has a mystical emphasis, and the majority in the Christian tradition, now how should we characterize them? I'm tempted to say that. It's the way of love and will, whereas for the Gnostics it's the way of knowledge, which is preeminent. Now, does that sound right?
Yes, I think at least the ones in their practice, they believe, they accept whatever they accept on faith and not.
Yeah, maybe that's a good way to put it.
Accepting.
Faith.
Beliefs that others have.
That's
given
right.
Them on faith.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I do sense a very real division among Christians, whether we've got the line rightly put or not. There's another way to put it. Well, let me just put it personally. In Syracuse, there are three couples of us. We're very good friends, and we actually institutionalize it minimally in the sense that once a month we build into our calendars, we have dinner together and just spend an evening together. And, you know, you wouldn't do that unless they were really good friends. And they all three of us have active religious interests. One would be the bishop of the United Church of Christ of upstate New York, if they had bishops. he's a kind of ecclesiastical executive at the very top. And another one, the man teaches in my department. Anyway, we all have. But though we're really good friends, it's very frustrating for my wife and myself too, because our religiosity takes very different turns. And how do we put it? Now, none of the categories, the distinctions that I've used thus far, really fits. But it's more like this, that I think of their Christianity as taking a direction of social action primarily. And that's good, you know. A lot of social action is needed, and a lot of things wrong with the world. We ought to do what we can with it. But and on that front, why, we're right along with them, you know. We vote for the same candidates, and we contribute to the same causes, have the same kind of sense of where the political scene should go and what. But for neither my wife nor I is that, what should we say, where religion is really at. Where it's really at for us is more like the kinds of concerns that we've been talking about today. And I don't think that any of those four people could sit through a day like this without asking something about what about Reagan, or what about this or that, so South America and liberation theology and something like that. Now again, just like the sudden doesn't rule out the gradual, I don't think that that's wrong. It's not that that's wrong. But I guess I never, like the linear, I don't see that that's ever going to get there. That the world is ever going to be, let's hope it smooths out and so on, but we're not going to get beyond the point where there are injustices, they'll change shape or something. And that if you bank it on that line, why, there's no solution. Now, that's the kind, and I would say that in worldview, even though we all use the word God and so on, but it seems to me that their worldview is, I can't see where it differs, really, from the standard American Western view of reality, because notions about the unseen or higher realms or things like that just seem never to enter into their concern. I don't know if that...
You don't think the two will ever synthesize.
Oh, I don't know.
For a while I had kind of the philosophy that things are pretty much going to keep on going on as they have been.
You mean in the world?
Yeah. In the world, yes. In the world.
Well, what do you think now? Do you continue?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know either. I don't know either.
I can find some answers to this.
Where do we stand on that?
I had an experience last year with John. Well, I guess the other one that was here. She was the one that, I guess, helped me get back down to this reality, which I guess the thing that I feel that I should write about is how the religions fit together, and I'm trying to get some answers as to how they do fit together. And it's part of the thing that you were saying of, okay, I was had the experience, and now I'm trying to bring it down to words to say, you know, what my experience was, but I don't know how to, what words to use to describe it.
I have a friend who has your exact viewpoint, and I have to confess, I'm probably closer to
my
your friend.
Yeah. Well, that's nice. That's kind of nice.
And we get along pretty well, and I've kind of worked it out. Not all together.
Right.
But to some extent.
I know the feeling.
Other concepts that for one, if you accept that there is an external force of some kind who participates mm-hmm. in an experience, mystical experience. In other words, if this is not totally self-generated, but requires some sort of force, love force, God force, who participates, then this same force which loves you or whoever has the mystical experience, by that term, establishes a pattern which in a lower form that we should do in our social activism. In other words, mm-hmm. it's a matter of being aware and loving mm-hmm. people and things, loving each other. Mm-hmm. And to this extent, why we've managed, we still speak to each other, and we're kind of like you are, and we get together quite often. Mm-hmm. But that's how we worked it out, and we spent a lot of evenings working on that too.
Yeah.
And that's as close as we've been able to get.
I had this friend that listens to Trinity broadcast 24 hours a day, I think, because every time I visit her. But then she is now where she can accept my experience. Mm-hmm. You know, that I did have some direct knowing of mm-hmm. certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But for a while she couldn't, for 6 months we couldn't even, although we had been best friends for 17 years, but we couldn't even talk to each other for 6 months.
In fact, that my friend's a very psychic. In fact, probably helps that. He's convinced me that he's psychic. It's your head. And I'm the hard head in the group. I've also convinced him that I'm not.
Okay,
we get on real well.
Extend Sunbear's invitation to us soft heads. To join him for a conclusion at the medicine wheel.
Oh, good.
And offering a concluding prayer before he disappears into the western sunset.
Something like this. I could travel very lightly if I knew exactly what would be useful, but I don't. So I always bring along a welter of stuff to look at on the plane and in off moments. On location. And this morning, just before I left the apartment, I was leafing through this kind of plethora of paper, snippets, odd items, and so on. And one of the things was a lecture that I'd read some time ago by Elaine Pagels. This is one she gave at Arizona State University called The Gnostic Jesus and Early Christian Politics. Well, I almost passed it by. I'd read it. What else? But offhand, my thumb opened it up, and I saw some writing up here. And let me read it. In a scribble that is not easily decipherable, it says, Bear Tribe, Sun Bear, Post Office Box 9167, Spokane, Washington, 97209. And then it says something I really can't. It looks like $1 per desire, but I can't believe that's right. But then it looks like $1 for a catalog or something. And then money smokes. Is there
many
smokes? Many smokes. And you know, I was reading this in Bloomington, Indiana last June. On that morning that I related yesterday, when I walked into this place for breakfast and spotted that ignorable figure there and went over and had my breakfast with Sun Bear, that that's a kind of synchronicity.
Yeah. Jung is dancing. Yeah. He's applauding, doing cartwheels right now.
And I think the most, what should we say, mind-blowing thing of all is that Gail, if you hadn't been a few minutes later than you expected, and if I hadn't just been sort of sitting there with all these things and my hand just went to that, this thing came within a moment of just being passed over, and I would never have known about this synchronicity. Pardon?
Everything is in perfect order.
It certainly is. It certainly is. Well, business matters. The luggage did appear. Everything is in perfect order. It was found. And I brought along some copies, two copies of each hardback covers, editions of my three books that are in print. And I shall be giving these as a donation to the, what is it, the Wild, what's the name of it? Wild Store?
Wild Store.
Wild Store.
And what I suggest is that those people who would like to acquire them from the Wild Store, do it not as an acquisition, but as a donation. And since Houston's giving them to us, you just make out a check or leave the amount of money that you're moved to as a contribution.
Wow.
And that will be your token of the contribution. How does that feel? Actually, it should be done through Leon, since it'll go through a different
Is that the forgotten truth?
Yes, they're the religions of man, and then forgotten truth, and then the most recent one appeared last summer, Beyond the Postmodern Mind.
Okay.
Right. I have only two copies, but if anyone wants one and these have gone, if you... let me know, I can send you. I have more at home. It's just that I don't like to carry them on airplanes. They're heavy.
Are these still in print?
all three are still in print. The first two, Religions of Man and Forgotten Truth, are now available in paperback only. All right. Now let's think, see if we should say a word about Joan. Are there any procedural matters? No?
Schedule? No, just those people who haven't, you know, registered or done whatever you haven't done. See Leon, which is well. Or Jane. I think Jane is getting some time this morning. And Leon will have the book for this. It's been great having you here. Very. You know, it's interesting. Sometimes people in certain programs create an immense amount of work, and this is terrible to say, but it's been a breeze. Your family here, Houston.
Well, we'll go till the 12:30 or 1-ish or something like that, and then we'll have. Somewhat abbreviated afternoon session because I will need to, I guess, leave this particular spot probably about 3:30 or 40 something, and then I guess it's I did bring the India and the Infinite film, the last film that I myself have made, and I could leave that. But then in the daylight, why, I don't know that it would show. And there's also the work of rigging up the power lines. We can leave that open.
Well, actually, last night's session was a bonus.
Uh-huh.
So it all balances out.
All balances out. Okay. All right. All right. With the recovery of my luggage from the airlines, I now have the course description. So we can see what we should have been doing and what we can recover in the remaining hours if we have not done it already. Gnosticism, a Western path towards Asia. Asian religions could not have established their recent beachhead in America had not something been lacking in the spiritual diet of the contemporary West. Yet it seems unlikely that the West will, quote unquote, convert to Asia. Cultural roots are too deep to allow for this kind of transplant. Now, the archaeological discovery of the Nag Hammadi library could provide a way out of this dilemma. That is to say, the dilemma of having to look abroad for what can only deeply affect us if it is found at home. Let me pause there, because I know many of you have been deeply affected by what you have found abroad and not at home. And that's true of myself too. But I'm talking about our nation, our Western civilization as a whole. So I think this statement does hold for our civilization. And let me say it again, the dilemma of having to look abroad for what can only deeply affect us if it is found at home. For what that library discloses is a Christian Gnosticism from gnosis to know, specifically to know in a way that saves. That presents, let me back up to omit that parenthetical phrase, for what that library discloses is a Christian Gnosticism that presents in Christian guise the features of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Sufism that Westerners find compelling. You see the thesis then that within Christian Gnosticism, the West might be able to find at home features which at present seem to be available only abroad. This seminar will note what those features are. Point by point, it will compare a representative Asian outlook, namely Buddhism, with the Gnostic Christianity that does three things. First, this Gnostic Christianity claims to be traceable to Christ himself. You recall the opening lines of the key document in those Gnostic Gospels, which begins, "These are the secret words which the living Jesus," see, "spoke to Thomas, and Thomas wrote down." So this Christian Gnosticism, first, claims to be traceable to Christ himself. Second, was suppressed because its individualism threatened the institutional structure of the Christian church. But third, which holds the promise for healing the schism in the Western soul, which we at present are sensing. And then it adds that Houston's interview with Krishnamurti will be shown and discussed. Now that has been fulfilled. All right. Now, let's go forward then. Yesterday we were on the subject of Gnosticism in general, and two basic things were done. First, to establish the precise meaning of gnosis, or Gnosticism that centers in gnosis. This precise meaning being knowledge, but knowledge of a very special variety, knowledge of the form that saves, knowledge in the guise that saves. And then the second thing that was done, we fumbled a little bit with capital G's and little G's, or Gnosticism 1, Gnosticism 2. Never mind how we slice it, but let me just say it personally. There's something about Gnosticism that I absolutely affirm, that I just causes me to say right out that I'm a Gnostic. And there's also an ingredient in Gnosticism that I don't like, that I reject. Now, I presented it personally, subjectively, but I'm really talking about this whole field of Gnosticism, because one finds both these things there. Now, the part that I like is this centering in gnosis as saving knowledge. And yesterday, when we began by identifying ourselves in a way that would disclose to others who we are in a way that would be most useful for our time together, I said, as one of my two statements, that I'm a jhana yogi. But now, today, if I were saying it, I would say I'm a Gnostic, because those are the yesterday's was simply an Asian way of saying what now I think we can say in Western terms. That is, I do feel that I live a lot in my head, but hopefully, certainly in the way to feel, not in a wheel-spinning way of the head, but in a way that really draws my life, and that's Gnostic knowing. The element that I do not like is the element which has a negative evaluation of this world, material existence, and the condition of life which is incarnated or involved with the physical material order. Now, that second one is much more subtle, and maybe it might be useful if right now we pause on that. Let me simply say that as we went into yesterday, classic, shall we say, Gnosticism had a very low opinion of this worldly life. And they tied that low opinion very much to its material involvement, which was a kind of entrapment. And therefore they saw salvation as liberation from this, sort of like you get the soul, not the soul, remember, but the spirit. You get the spirit out of matter a little bit like you remove a piston from a syringe, you know, just an actual extrication, because there's no help, no hope, as long as there is this involvement. All right. Now, is there any truth in that? Let's wait. That's the $64 question on this issue. We can see that there's an untruth in it. Can't we? I mean, we just look around. It's hard to. It may be easier for you, for whom this climate and this part of the world is a way of life, but for someone coming into it from Syracuse, where winter is already upon us, why, it's very hard to take this negative view of nature and matter, you know, seriously. Maybe if I'd been here 4 days ago, well, we could talk about that. Well, I think we see the issue, and let's just pause on that a little bit. What do we do about these two components of this problem, or don't you see it as a problem? I see it as